WBEZ is supported by the Gynecology Research Lab at Endeavor Health. Period pain affects millions of people. Researchers want to learn from those experiencing period pain. The NIH-funded study wants to know whether a common over-the-counter medication can reduce period pain over time. Compensation is available. Learn more at cureperiodpain.org.
The Obamas say they hope the space will inspire people to build community and become more civically engaged.
To my fellow Southsiders, use this campus to show off this place we call home.
How's it been having this new center in the community?
The truth.
Yeah.
It's beautiful.
Hey, Chicago. I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is In the Loop. It's Friday, and we're breaking down the biggest stories of the week in our weekly news recap. Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson signs an executive order establishing a dedicated Office of Gun Violence Reduction after violence during the holiday weekend. Thousands attend the opening of the Obama Presidential Center, and Chicago is suing Airbnb. Plus, the Supreme Court allows the end of temporary protected status for Haitian and Syrian immigrants.
Temporary Protected Status, or TPS, was created by Congress decades ago.
The Supreme Court here today is clearing the way for the Trump administration to end the temporary protected status.
Haiti is in a point where if there's ever a time that there were people were going to come to America to seek protection and asylum, it would be now.
Mass shootings like what happened over the weekend in Roseland are up nearly 20% from a year ago.
Chicago deserves better. It is time for our infrastructure to reflect the urgency of this crisis.
We'll get into those stories and much more. At the table to help me make sense of the week's news was Chicago Sun-Times reporter Violet Miller, Maxwell Evans, who covers Hyde Park, Woodlawn, and South Shore for Block Club Chicago, and Paris Schutz, political and investigative reporter for NBC5. We started our conversation by getting an update about TPS with Chicago Sun-Times immigration reporter Alma Campos. Here's Alma.
TPS stands for Temporary Protected Status. Congress created it in 1990 for people already in the United States who cannot safely return home because of war, natural disaster, or other extreme conditions. And it lets people live and work legally in the United States temporarily, but it is not a direct path to a green card or citizenship.
Mm-hmm. And how many countries are on the TPS list?
So the federal government has one current list, which is 12 countries, but broader counts include countries where protections were recently ended or are still tied up in court. Venezuelans have been the largest group of TPS holders, roughly 600,000 people, mm-hmm. and their status has also been the subject of major legal fights.
So this ruling yesterday, I mean, is it impacting people from all of those countries?
No, this ruling directly affects people from Haiti and Syria because those were the countries at issue in this case. But advocates say it could matter for other TPS holders too, including Venezuelans, who are the largest group. So the immediate impact is Haiti and Syria, but the legal signal is broader.
How many people in Illinois are going to be affected by this?
So in Illinois, more than 46,000 Haitians have TPS overall and several hundred Syrians. This ruling directly, you know, affects Haitians and Syrians. And nationally, the ruling directly affects about 350,000 Haitians and about 6,000 Syrians.
That's a lot of people. Wow. And what are we hearing so far? You know, it's just been about 24 hours or so, but, you know, Illinois officials and advocates, are they weighing in so far on the ruling?
Yes. So Illinois officials and advocates are calling the ruling devastating. They say it could put hundreds of thousands of people at risk of losing work permits and protection from deportation, even though Haiti and Syria remain unsafe. Congresswoman Delia Ramirez and Senator Dick Durbin are calling on Congress to act, meaning pass legislation that would give TPS holders a more permanent way to stay in the United States or create stronger protections before an administration can end TPS. And then Senator Tammy Duckworth also criticized TPS terminations more broadly, warning that they can force people back into dangerous conditions. And advocates say the ruling could destabilize families who have lived and worked legally in the U.S. for years.
Can this be challenged?
So advocates say the ruling makes challenges much harder. I mean, the ACLU of Northern California says most challenges to TPS terminations are now blocked, except you know, constitutional claims. So TPS holders or immigrant rights groups could still try to sue, but the path is much narrower. And that is why advocates are also pushing Congress to pass a law giving TPS holders a more permanent way to stay.
All right. So, I mean, where can folks here in Illinois and in Chicago find support in the meantime? Because there's so much in the air right now.
So advocates say people should talk to a qualified immigration attorney before making any decisions. In Chicago and Illinois, they can contact the National Immigrant Justice Center, Illinois Legal Aid Online, the Legal Aid Chicago, or the state's Immigrant Family Support Hotline, which is 1-855-HELP-MY-FAMILY. So that's 1-855-435-7693.
Thank you for that. We'll certainly keep an eye as this moves forward. That's Sun-Times immigration reporter Alma Campos. We appreciate you checking in.
Thank you.
Now, we were just talking about the Supreme Court. The justices also struck down Hawaii's law requiring gun owners to get permission before carrying a gun onto private property. I'm talking about grocery stores and coffee shops and gas stations that are open to the public. And Violet, I want to just sort of bring things back home here because last weekend in Chicago, we saw a lot of gun violence, didn't we? Right. 8 people died, 40 wounded. And Mayor Johnson, as a result, is now taking steps to create a new Department of Gun Violence Reduction. So talk about what this department might actually look like and the kind of budget that it would have.
Yeah. So, I mean, the details are pretty scarce so far. We don't really have a lot of the kind of, you know, nitty gritty what this would look like in terms of staffing. We know that they're aiming for $100 million in the budget coming from existing public safety funds. That would be about 3% of the annual public safety budget for the city of Chicago. By comparison, CPD gets $2.1 billion, or about 67% of that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, one of the biggest things, you know, and I know Paris has some to share on this as well, is that this they're aiming to have procurement ability, which means they could contract, they could, you know, hire different groups such as violence interrupters to be on the city payroll to work at this.
Yeah. So this ruling, I mean, I wonder, do you think it could slow down or block the new city department, the one I just shared from the Supreme Court?
Yeah, it doesn't seem like it'll have a direct impact. This is a ruling that's, you know, a little bit kind of bigger scope, I guess. But as advocates have said for years, I mean, just the pervasiveness of guns in our, you know, cities and communities is going to lead to violence. So if there are more guns in more places, I think it's safe to assume that that's going to be, you know, what we're seeing. But it is important to throw in context that, you know, Chicago's violence is on a large downtrend. I mean, last year we saw the fewest homicides in the city since 1965. And that's a continued 4-year downward trend.
Mm-hmm. Maxwell, I want to turn to you because I know that you've interviewed plenty of violence prevention workers on the South Side specifically. Do you think this new city agency could give them the kind of government support that they've been asking for?
Yeah, so I do think there would need to be a few more details released about what exactly this department would do. But speaking to what I've heard from violence prevention workers, two of the most common things are the need for more money and the need for people to kind of get out of silos and work collaboratively. So I do think a department that does both of those things, offers funding to these organizations, and as well as kind of gets them together towards their shared goals as opposed to working in silos, that's the kind of a department I think that violence prevention workers would really appreciate.
Yeah, you had some thoughts, Paris, on this department?
Well, I think there's a lot of questions, as Violet is saying, and Maxwell, we just don't know what this office is going to look like, mm-hmm. what it's going to do, and how is it different from the current Office of Community Safety under the mayor? I mean, that office is supposed to be working with these groups and with the police department, and it's not as if that violence prevention is shortchanged in the budget. I mean, there's tens of millions of dollars that goes to violence prevention work. And I think the concern with an office like this and having direct procurement authority is that it could become an insider's game. We interviewed a violence prevention worker, Reverend Sandy. Her last name is escaping me. Reverend Sandy, we'll call her. And she was saying, well, hey, I wasn't involved in crafting this office, so I know none of the contracts are going to go to me. It's going to go to the same old people. And so, you know, Alderman Brian Hopkins is saying, well, you know, the potential for fraud here is bad when you don't have oversight. And an office is just going to, you know, give out contracts without going through the procurement agency. You know, stuff could go wrong. And I'm not saying that's a given, but it just looks like a lot of these groups that are close with CTU and the mayor want a more direct access to getting this funding. And of course they need the funding, but then there's conflicting reporting in terms of, do all the groups utilize the funding in the best way?
Earlier this week, I also talked to a couple of violence interrupters in the city, as well as Emmanuel Andre, the city's new community safety deputy
and he
mayor.
Would be the head of this new office too.
And from him, it sounds like a lot more conversations just need to be had. They haven't quite hashed out what this is going to look like. So we'll keep an eye. How about President Trump weighing in though on the weekend about how Chicago should handle its violence?
I think he was bored, and you know, he just was looking at the headlines and the, you know, a violent weekend and saying, this is a good opportunity.
And for folks who don't know, he went on to Truth Social.
He went on to Truth Social saying, why doesn't the governor call me for assistance, for help? And you know, the governor kind of came back and said, well, I would take more federal ATF agents. I would take more federal FBI agents. I would take more DEA agents. I mean, that's the help that the city always welcomes. I mean, more boots on the ground in terms of, you know, traditional law enforcement is not something folks will turn down. But if the president wants to go back to, you know, the note that he was singing a year ago and saying National Guard, That's when local leaders will stand up and say, we don't want that. That's intimidation. We have an election coming up. The National Guard is not trained in violence prevention.
Let's turn to something else while you're in the hot seat there. Something else city council is grappling with is Alders getting an earful from Bally's. This is about their decision to lift that ban on video gambling terminals.
Yeah. And so basically Bally's is building that casino and they have the sole right to operate a casino in Chicago. So they thought their contract meant, well, that means you can't have video gaming terminals in bars and restaurants. It doesn't really say that. I don't see in the contract where it says that basically the city has to pay a penalty if they allow VGT, video gaming terminals. And so, as we know, this year, city council did authorize, legalize video gaming in Chicago in bars and restaurants. Bally says it's going to cannibalize their business. Mm-hmm. And so if you don't pass an ordinance to rescind video gaming, then we might sue. We're going to consider all legal avenues.
And Mayor Johnson opposes these, right?
Mayor Johnson siding with Bally's here. Mayor Johnson is opposed to the video gaming terminals in bars and restaurants. So he wants this ordinance passed to rescind them. Does it have the support? I don't know. Alderman Anthony Beal is very supportive of video gaming, but there's the other wrinkle here. Sweepstakes machines. This other thing that's kind of operates in a legal gray area where, you know, a bunch of bars and restaurants have these sweepstakes machines that are not supposed to give out money. That's the difference.
Yeah.
But the thing is, they're supposed to give you a gift if you win something, if you win the game. What happens in most of these sweepstakes machines is you win, and then you go to the bar, and the bartender gives you some cash. And so Beal is like, hey, Bally's, if you're so upset about video gaming, how come you're not upset about sweepstakes? So he believes it's hypocrisy. Does Bally's have a legal case to make? I don't know. Hmm. It doesn't seem like it. But certainly, they're having their own trouble, and they want to have every advantage that they can. And so video gaming in bars and restaurants would seem to cut into their business. One other thing they offered was, hey, what if we just did video gaming in the airports? We're cool with that.
Yeah. So
how about just that?
Well, Maxwell and Violet, I want to know, because they're proposing this in lounges at O'Hare and Midway. How do you feel? I mean, is that a fun time to pass the, a fun way to pass the time away if your flight's delayed?
Personally, I'm very, having those opportunities to gamble, I want to take as many of those off the table as possible.
Maxwell jumps right in.
Yeah, I've got too many friends that are struggling with online gambling or things that technically aren't gambling but definitely are gambling. It's just, to me, it's a way to kind of enable those kinds of addictions in ways that can be very harmful.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm really not trying to see more of that or have more opportunities for that.
Yeah.
And they're starting it off with kids and like video games and things now too. Yeah. I mean, it's conditioned very young.
So you're not gambling while you wait for that flight.
I will be reading a book.
Yeah.
Very, very much more productive way to spend your time. But, you know, don't forget about sports wagering on your phone.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's like, you know, so the video gaming people are like, Bally's, like, you've got competition everywhere and it's fine. So why not let bars and restaurants that need a critical lifeline, some revenue from this? But you're right. I mean, It does feel kind of like a societal collapse when we're just expanding gambling and sin, you know, sinful behaviors so much to make money.
Well, you have had a couple of busy weeks.
Most definitely.
you were out there reporting quite a bit on the lead up to the Obama Presidential Center's opening weekend. I hope you've had a couple of days to rest.
Honestly, I've been saying that the busy part was the 7 years of covering the run up to the Obama Center. The celebration itself was a party for me.
That was a breeze.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, what should we know about the highlights from that 4-day grand opening?
Yeah, so I think it was really a display of all of the excitement that's been building up around this project, as well as the concerns and how both of those things are existing at the exact same time. You look at the residents who are very excited to have what's essentially a global destination right in their backyard in a park that they frequent in their neighborhood. That's a very exciting time to be in a resident of Woodlawn, Hyde Park, South Shore, and the South Lakefront. There's also concerns about the impacts that will have on housing, on economic development, on what the neighborhood's going to look like in 5 to 10 years. And so, yeah, having those truths all coexist, it's frankly a hectic time to live in the neighborhood.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because since the 2021 groundbreaking, we have heard a lot of concerns from people in the surrounding communities. But from folks you were talking to over the past weekend, I mean, did it seem like Southsiders maybe they're more supportive of this center now?
Again, I do think it's kind of these truths coexisting at the same time.
They're like kind of teetering on the fence a little
bit. Exactly. Like, you can have somebody that's very excited about the prospects and very concerned if they'll be in the neighborhood to experience them. So I do think it's less of a binary thing, and it's more of like, yeah, all of these kind of truths existing as once.
Yeah. I was there Friday. We did some special coverage here at WBEZ, marking the official first day that the doors open to the public. Paris and Violet, I mean, have either of you stepped onto the campus grounds yet?
I need to get in line to get tickets that are sold out.
There's another batch
releasing next week. Another batch going on sale. Yeah, no special treatment for folks in the media. You know, I wonder the folks, the community benefits folks that were worried about the gentrification of the neighborhood. I wonder what the ultimate impact is going to be on that. The traffic, you know, I know the folks were not happy about the traffic being shut down, but it was I have to say, to bring Bruce Springsteen and Bono and John Legend and the King of Kings, Stevie Wonder, to the South Side.
Yeah.
What a great thing. You know, let's put politics aside. I'm happy to see the South Side, and, you know, have an event like that with so much talent. And, hey, you know, like, what if the Bears Stadium goes to the U.S. Steel site? Now the South Side's got all kinds of tourist attractions.
So it sounds like you think this will be transformative. It could be transformative for that area.
I think there's some skepticism. You know, are people really going to go visit this thing? Well, if it's sold out for several months, you've got the Griffin Museum there. To create reasons for tourists and Chicagoans to travel en masse to the South Side is a good thing. There needs to be more foot traffic in the South Side. There needs to be more reason to go to the South Side to develop these great historic neighborhoods like Hyde Park, Hyde Park's pretty developed, but Bronzeville, Jackson Park, Woodlawn,
South Shore, anything
that can be a catalyst to make the South Side, you know, what it has been, which is a great place.
On the other side of that, I mean, the only times I've been to the campus, because I have not been inside yet either, the only time I've been there is, you know, doing something similar to Maxwell, talking to these residents. I mean, I remember speaking to Hattie Kanazi, a 77-year-old breast cancer survivor whose property taxes shot up $4,000 in 2024. And then Christiana Powell, who was evicted from her family home that they had owned since the 50s. Mm. So I think there's a lot of, you know, conflicting feelings, the impact this is already having on the South Side in the area. In addition to, you know, I think a lot of folks have had a reckoning with Obama's legacy in the last couple of years. I mean, the drone strikes that had a 10% civilian victim rate and more than 3,000 victims. I mean, that sticks out as we see these boat drone strikes that, you know, the Trump administration is doing now.
Yeah. So, I mean, to that end, Maxwell, some of the stuff that Paris and Violet just talked about, are residents, would you say they're gearing up for the possibility that more tourists are coming to the South Side, all that foot traffic?
Yeah, for example, in Woodlawn, you look at an organization like Blacks in Green, which has been in the neighborhood for about a decade at this point. They're setting up a Woodlawn and South Lakefront Tourism Center, hosting tours, bikes, walking tours, that kind of thing. And you also see a lot of short-term rentals starting to pop up in the neighborhood, where it is things like Airbnb that homeowners, property owners are looking to capitalize on that. I do think there's the, as well as existing hotels in the area in Hyde Park, and new ones that may be developed along Stony Island and with the Woodlawn Center. Agricultural Development that just passed this week through Plan Commission. Yeah, there's a lot of work being done already and infrastructure being built to prepare for this influx of tourists they're expecting.
Well, I just want to make sure I note for listeners, we just mentioned the fact that a new batch of tickets are opening up, but I want you to know when you can get them. So it's happening for the general public on July 8th. All right. That'll be for visits from September 2026 through January 2027, because that center sold out completely through till November. So you gotta jump on it, folks. July 8th. On to some other news here. Chicago's suing Airbnb and one of the city's most active hosts for improper short-term rentals. What should we know, Violet?
Yeah, so essentially this lawsuit is over a South Loop Airbnb host who wasn't registering the properties properly as these short-term rentals, as you're required to do in the city of Chicago. This, you know, landlord was issued citations. Airbnb, you know, according to the city, was profiting off of this then illegal, you know, domicile for this short-term rental. And so the city is looking to recuperate those profits. As well as crack down on Airbnb owners who aren't, you know, registering their properties properly. As Maxwell said, you know, we're seeing a lot of these pop up around the Obama Center, downtown, in a lot of these other attractions. And that's kind of inevitably taking housing off the market. Mm-hmm. So this might be a twofold push from the city, in addition to, you know, just trying to keep, you know, housing prices cool for folks, because the more of these short-term rentals, the more that, you know, rent, mortgages, things like that, property taxes even can go up.
Yeah, Maxwell, short-term rental licenses have increased by 46% since 2019 in the 20th Ward, which, of course, includes most of the Woodlawn community just west of the center.
Yeah, and I think you hear from a lot of homeowners who are very excited about that opportunity. Again, it's a way to make some passive income, to have a way to capitalize.
I can capitalize off this.
Exactly. The Obama Center is not only in my backyard to visit, but also to make money off of. But yeah, the flip side of that is that could be a rental home that could be helping to drive down rental prices for renters. So it is kind of a back and forth between the homeowners and the renters as to whether that's a good thing or not.
Exactly. Affordable housing is something that we're grappling with at both the national and state level. This week, President Trump refused to sign a sweeping housing reform package. It was passed by Congress one day, and Governor Pritzker's affordable housing plan also didn't pass in the spring session. So clearly this is something that we're going to keep hearing a lot more about. Other legislation that failed to pass in Illinois' spring session would have regulated data centers, Paris.
Yeah.
The governor's not giving up, though.
No, the governor, he signed an executive order rescinding tax breaks that data centers received that he signed into law, by the way. He was a proponent of data centers many years ago until, you know, the last couple of years where they become toxic pretty much on both sides of the aisle. I think because of the concerns of AI and the concerns that they suck up lots of energy, they suck up lots of water. We visited Elk Grove Village, which is the data center capital of the Midwest. They have
Who knew?
They proudly proclaim they have more data centers per capita than any place else in the Midwest.
They've got, what, 20?
20 online, five more being built right now. And the mayor there says, hey, our utility bills are high, but they're no higher than the surrounding burbs. And he claims that the data centers in operation do not use a whole ton of the town's water. They basically pipe in water and then they recycle it. So they reuse it. So it's what's called a closed loop system.
Ah.
So he says, like, you know, the concerns about water use can be addressed by technology and by using these closed loop system. He says they provide $26 million in revenue to the town. And, you know, Elk Grove Village kind of can handle this because it's got dedicated business parks that are far away from any residential area, and they're by O'Hare. So I think there are areas of the state where data centers make sense, and there are areas that they don't make sense.
Yeah.
Obviously, if you're in a densely populated geographic area, then a data center is probably not going to be a good thing to be popping up in your backyard. But if you've got business parks, tech parks, but, you know,
it might make more sense.
But still, the governor wants in the veto session lawmakers to come back and consider a couple things, mainly regulation that the data centers would have to produce their own energy, or at least be neutral in certain terms of they produce as much energy as they take off the grid. Mm-hmm. Maybe that would help bring some costs down.
Well, Maxwell, you attended a community forum in Little Village about data centers. Real quick, did you hear a lot of pushback from residents?
I think, frankly, the entire event was kind of focused on the pushback, especially in, as you mentioned, Paris, like the density of Chicago. There's really a resistance to putting a large scale on one of these massive data centers in the area.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially the entire event was talking through the impacts of that and voicing people's frustrations.
And just a quick note on those closed loop systems, they do still use a very significant amount of water. It's kind of a myth that some of these companies have been perpetuating that it's the more environmentally friendly data center, and that just doesn't really exist. You know, they're still using large amounts of water, albeit a little bit less than some of the other ones.
And one of their favorite talking points in the industry is laundromats use more water, golf courses use more water. Car washes use more water.
Golf courses do use a lot of water, right. So they might have a point there.
I have not gone and done my own empirical. I don't know the answer. Is that true? I don't know. But, you know, in terms of Little Village, another thing that data center proponents will say is like, well, consider like logistics hubs. Those can sometimes be even worse because you've got the exhaust from trucks coming in and out. So it's a great debate, and it's going to keep going on and on and on.
It's definitely going to keep going. But Violet, I want to pivot to a story here that you covered before we take a pause. 19 Illinoisans, including three from Chicago, they're being charged with healthcare fraud.
Yeah, so this was a massive nationwide indictment against 450 people. As you said, 19 in Illinois, three in Chicago. Among them, Daniel Robinson, a Palos Park resident who was accused of overcharging for $45 million in services through his methadone clinic. Prosecutors saying he bought cars, yachts, jewelry, and real estate with it, though his lawyer denies it and says that, you know, the regulatory bodies in charge of this industry already would have caught that earlier on. Mm. I think an interesting thing here, though, is the DOJ and Andrew Boutros' office in Chicago here working with the Illinois Attorney General and a lot of other state attorney generals, seemingly borrowing a little bit of credibility because they've needed to recently after the fallout of the Broadview 6. With, you know, all of these, 20 years of cases being, you know, looked over. I mean, they need everything they can get. So working with the state attorney general seemed to be their kind of way of getting it co-signed.
The candidates continue to line up for the 2027 Chicago mayoral race. This week, it was the former operating chairman of the Chicago Housing Authority. He's been a vocal critic of Mayor Johnson, accusing the mayor of dividing Chicago. So tell me how you think this race is shaping
up so
far.
It's very interesting. Yeah, this is not his first battle against Mayor Johnson. Mm-hmm. So he rebuffed the mayor when the mayor wanted to install Walter Burnett, his ally, as the new CEO of the Chicago Housing Authority, the massive billion-dollar agency here. And Brewer, who was the operational chairman of the board there, said, not on my watch. We have our own process. We went and found our own person, and he was voted in by our board, and that person took over a few weeks ago, and Johnson lost that, and Johnson threatened to sue. Mm-hmm. They were looking into all legal options, so Brewer really publicly stood up against the mayor, and so it's a very interesting challenger here for the mayor, because right now all the candidates and the ones talked about being candidates kind of are operating in the same lane here, kind of to the center, more center, moderate, center left, where, you know, Brandon Johnson's very progressive. So Brewer, does he occupy a progressive lane that could, you know, really take votes away from Brandon Johnson? Also, as an African-American, mm-hmm. I don't know if Willie Wilson is officially in yet, but right now would be the only other African-American.
Lots of speculation that he will.
In the race, which could that siphon votes away? So I think this is a candidate that most people probably don't know. He'd probably have to build up his name recognition. But one that would probably concern people in the Brandon Johnson camp.
Mm-hmm. Now, the biggest pride parade in the Midwest is this Sunday. Violet, it's been a tough year for the LGBTQ plus community.
To put it lightly.
You know, you got the Trump administration targeting literally everything, all your rights and funding for programs. So talk to us about a lawsuit against a West Suburban organization offering gender affirming care.
Yeah, this is so they actually don't offer gender affirming care. They only offer guidance, right? So they offer guidance to other, doctors, organizations. They're kind of like a major medical organization. The WPATH, as they're known, the World Professional Association for Trans Health. The FTC is suing them as the latest Trump administration attack on gender affirming care for youth. They're saying that they gave faulty information and guidance and they profited from this. It follows an FTC investigation into the East Dundee based group. group, but that also followed investigations into other major medical organizations for the same reason, which was recently blocked by a federal judge. So they are not allowed to continue that investigation until an appeal. And in the meantime, they've decided to file suit. So again, this is the latest attack. I mean, the Trump administration has tried executive orders, lawsuits, regulatory changes, DOJ subpoenas for children's health information, all of which have failed so far, but obviously still make an impact. Most of Chicago's hospitals have stopped offering gender-affirming care for folks under 19 years old. And, you know, WPATH says this is retaliation, pure and simple. They said that the Trump administration was going to its, quote, go-to obedient state's attorneys to help in its unlawful bidding. So pretty strongly refuting that.
Wow. Now, it wouldn't be a weekly news recap if we didn't have an update on the ongoing stadium saga.
What stadium saga?
No.
Talking about the fire?
No, no, no. The Bears, of course.
Oh, them. Okay.
What's the latest?
What's the latest? I have no idea. I don't even know if the Bears know what the latest is. I mean, I think there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of scuttlebutt that they're working secretly with Illinois lawmakers on a bill that's more tailored to exactly what they want. I think they've denied that. Pritzker made that claim. Other lawmakers, like, I don't really see that happening right now. I mean, there are two options for the Bears. There's the pilot, you know, the payment in lieu of taxes, which passed the House, and there's the stadium public authority that passed the Senate. The Bears are partial to the one that passed the House, although they wanted tweaks on that one. And until, you know, I think we should just kind of cool our jets until we hear lawmakers say we've got a special session. We're going to go back down and pass a they're not going to organize a special session unless they know they have the votes to pass.
Right.
So that's when we know there'll be movement. Now, I've looked at Hammond a lot, and from I've done stories where they want to build, they do not have the room to build because of environmental issues and protections that are there for wetlands and some restoration that happened there. So it just doesn't make much sense what exactly their plan is in Hammond, because we still don't have a specific
plan. This has just been one confusing story.
And so the last, you know, like the Department of Environment in Indiana, they sent me this very interesting statement saying we have had no one apply for a permit for there's no plan. There's no proposals. There's nothing official yet.
So
anywhere.
How does the board say weeks ago, like we are moving forward?
The board,
with
Hammond. I mean, it wasn't really, it was kind of like sound and fury signifying nothing with Faulkner. You know, it's like, yes, we're moving forward on Hammond, but they already were. And it doesn't mean that it's a done deal or that there's a plan yet.
Geez. Well, that is not, believe it or not, the only stadium news in the recap this week. We've been long told that the Chicago Fire Stadium would be privately funded. Last week, though, the mayor asked the city council to approve a $425 million taxpayer subsidy. What is going on with that project?
And that would be, you know, the TIF, those the TIFs that everybody loves
tax
to talk
increment
about.
Tax increment financing,
which, you know, he's gotten some criticism that, well, hey, he's given a lot of that money to schools, or at least surplus TIF money to education. That's his big cause. So why are you helping out a private interest here? But, you know, the 78 where the stadium's going to go is a parcel of land that the city has wanted to develop for years and years and years. And ostensibly, that is what TIF money is for. It's to build infrastructure to help develop a community. So that's a lot of money.
Yeah,
criminy. What word can I use
here? Easy.
I didn't want to say the whatever. I can say crap. Okay, holy crap.
Not on this station.
That's a lot. I'm sorry, listeners.
All right.
But anyway, that's a lot of money. But it's to develop a neighborhood in a very important parcel of land. So, you know, you could argue that that is the appropriate use of TIF money. That's just a big amount.
Yeah. Well, Maxwell, pivoting here, we talked earlier about the Juneteenth holiday and how that was celebrated at the Obama Presidential Center. But there was also a fun event in neighboring South Shore on Father's Day. What should we know about the annual Speed in Action Rodeo Horse Show?
Yeah, so this is a big kind of celebration of Black cowboys, not only on the South Side, not only in the city of Chicago, but throughout Chicagoland. Mm-hmm. I do think there's a lot of people that don't know that that's a scene that exists here
it's
in Chicago.
It's a beautiful display, right? I mean, we did, believe it or not, we did a live broadcast from there I was counting on the calendar 3 years ago.
Beautiful.
I was blown away. I said, where were these people all along? I didn't know that there was a whole black cowboy community in Chicago. And of course, I did my homework at that time. But yeah.
Yeah. In addition to the rodeo, there's also the annual High Noon Ride that starts in Washington Park. Sometimes you'll just see the odd horse rider along the lakefront trail. It's really a vibrant and beautiful scene. And yeah, the Speed and Action Rodeo Show, that's their annual get together at the South Shore Cultural Center, where Chicagoans can come in the middle of the city and come and see a good old Western rodeo. So a lovely time out there.
It's so cool. So cool. Did you have a good time?
I actually wasn't able to make it this year, but definitely planning to make it for the High Noon Ride here coming up next month.
Oh,
it's
good.
Always such a good, I mean, it's basically going and having a picnic, seeing these beautiful horses, seeing how well cared for they are throughout the region. Yeah, it's always a lovely time to get out there.
Awesome. We look forward to your reporting. Guess what, folks? We're out of time. That is it.
Already?
Yes. Time flies when you're having fun. That's it for the weekly news recap. My thanks to Violet Miller of the Chicago Sun-Times, Maxwell Evans of Block Club Chicago, and NBC5's Paris Schatz. Have a great weekend.
This episode of the In the Loop podcast was produced by me, Andrea Guffman, and edited by Ethan Schwab. Sasha Ann Simons is our host. For more in-depth coverage of news and culture in Chicago, be sure to subscribe to this podcast. For a full archive of the show, head over to wbez.org/InTheLoop. Thanks for listening.